Welcome to a Playhouse presentation of classic adventure stories, Huckleberry Finn. It must have been close on to 1 o'clock when we got below the island at last, and the raft did seem to go mighty slow. If a boat was to come along, we was going to take the canoe and break for the Illinois shore. And it was well a boat didn't come, for we hadn't ever thought to put the gun in the canoe or a fishing line or anything to eat. We was in rather too much of a hurry. It weren't good judgment to put everything on the raft. If the men went to the island, I just expect they found the campfire I built and watched all night for Jim to come. Anyways, they stayed away from us. And if my building the fire never fooled them, it weren't no fault of mine. I played it as low down on them as I could. When the first streak of day began to show, we tied up to a towhead in a bend on the Illinois side and hacked off cottonwood branches with a hatchet and covered up the raft with them, so she looked like there had been a cave-in in the bank there. A towhead is a sandbar that has cottonwoods on it as thick as harrow teeth. We had mountains on the Missouri shore and heavy timber on the Illinois side, and the channel was down the Missouri shore at that place, so we weren't afraid of anybody running across us. We laid there all day and watched the rafts and steamboats spin down the Missouri shore and upbound steamboats fight the big river in the middle. I told Jim all about the time I had jabbering with that woman, and Jim said she was a smart one, and if she was to start after us herself, she wouldn't sit down and watch a campfire, no sir. She'd fetch a dog. Well, I said, why couldn't she tell her husband to fetch a dog? Jim said, he bet she didn't think of it by the time the men was ready to start, and he believed they must have gone uptown to get a dog, and so they lost all that time, or else we wouldn't be here on the towhead 16 or 17 mile below the village. No, indeedy. We would be in that same town again. So I said, I didn't care what the reason was, they didn't get us as long as they didn't. When it was beginning to come on to dark, we poked our heads out of the cottonwood thicket and looked up and down and across, nothing in sight. So Jim took up some of the top planks of the raft and built a snug wigwam to get under in blazing weather and rainy, and to keep the things dry. Jim made a floor for the wigwam and raised it a foot or more above the level of the raft, so now the blankets and all the traps was out of reach of the steamboat waves. Right in the middle of the wigwam, we made a layer of dirt about 5 or 6 inches deep with a frame around it for to hold it to its place. This was to build a fire on in sloppy weather or chilly. The wigwam would keep it from being seen. We made an extra steering oar too, because one of the others might get broke on a snag or something. We fixed up a short forked stick to hang the old lantern on, because we must always light the lantern whenever we see a steamboat coming downstream to keep from getting run over. But we wouldn't have to light it for upstream boats unless we see we was in what they call a crossing, for the river was pretty high yet, very low banks, being still a little underwater. So upbound boats didn't always run the channel, but hunted up easy water. The second night, it was different. Yep, the second night, We run between 7 and 8 hours with a current that was making over 4 miles an hour. We catch some fish and talked, and we took a swim now and then to keep off sleepiness. It was kind of solemn, drifting down the big, still river, laying on our backs, looking up at the stars, and we didn't even feel like talking loud. And it weren't often that we laughed, only a little kind of a low chuckle. We had mighty good weather as a general thing, and nothing ever happened to us at all, that night, nor the next, nor the next. Every night, we passed towns. Some of them, away up on black hillsides, nothing but just a shiny bed of lights, not a house could you see. The fifth night, we passed St. Louis, and it was like the whole world lit up. In St. Petersburg, they used to say that there was 20 or 30,000 people up in St. Louis, but I never believed it, till I saw that wonderful spread of lights at 2 o'clock that still night. There weren't a sound there. Everybody was asleep. Every night now, I used to slip ashore toward 10 o'clock at some little village and buy 10 or 15 cents worth of meal or bacon or other stuff to eat. And sometimes I lifted a chicken that weren't roosting comfortable and took him along. Pap always said, take a chicken when you get a chance, because if you don't want him yourself, you can easy find somebody that does, and a good deed ain't never forgot. I never see Pap when he didn't want the chicken himself, but that's what he used to say anyway. Mornings before daylight, I slipped into cornfields and borrowed a watermelon, or a mushmelon, or a pumpkin, or some new corn or things of that kind. Pap always said it weren't no harm to borrow things if you was meaning to pay them back sometime. But the widow said it weren't anything but a soft name for stealing, and no decent body would do it. Jim said he reckoned the widow was partly right, and Pap was partly right. So the best way would be for us to pick up 2 or 3 things from the list and say we wouldn't borrow them anymore. Then he reckoned it wouldn't be no harm to borrow the others. So we talked it over all one night, drifting all along the river, trying to make up our minds whether to drop the watermelons or the cantaloupes or the mushmelons or what. But toward daylight, we got it all settled, satisfactory, and concluded to drop crabapples and persimmons. We weren't feeling just right before that, but it was all comfortable now. It was glad the way it come out, too. We shot a waterfowl now and then that got up too early in the morning or didn't go to bed early enough in the evening. Take it all around, we lived pretty high. The fifth night below St. Louis, we had a big storm after midnight, with the power of thunder and lightning, and the rain poured down in a solid sheet. We stayed in the wigwam and let the raft take care of itself. When the lightning glared out, we could see a big straight river ahead and high rocky bluffs on both sides. By and by, says I, hello, Jim, looky yonder. It was a steamboat that had killed herself on a rock. We were drifting straight down for her. The lightning showed her very distinct. She was leaning over with part of her upper deck above water, and you could see every little chimbley guy clean and clear, and a chair by the big bell with an old slouch hat hanging on the back of it. You could see it when the flashes come.
Thank you.
Well, it being away in the night, and stormy, and also mysterious-like, I felt just the way any other boy would have felt when I seen that wreck laying there so mournful and lonesome in the middle of the river. I wanted to get aboard of her and slink around a little and see what there was, so I says, "Let's land on her, Jim." But Jim was dead against it at first. He says, "I don't want to go fooling longer in no wreck. We's doing blame well, and we better let blame well enough alone, as the good book says. Like as not, there's a watchman on that wreck." "Watchman, your grandmother," I says. "There ain't nothing to watch but the Texans and the pilot house. And do you reckon anybody's gonna risk his life for a Texas and a pilot house on such a night as this? When it's likely to break up and wash off down the river at any minute?" Jim couldn't say nothing to that, so he didn't try. "And besides," I says, "we might borrow something worth having out of the captain's stateroom. Seagars, I betcha, and cost 5 cents apiece, solid cash. Steamboat captains is always rich and get $60 a month, and they don't care what a cent, what a thing costs, you know, as long as they want it. Stick a candle in your pocket. I can't rest. Till we get her a rummaging, Jim, I just can't rest. Do you reckon Tom Sawyer would ever go buy this thing? Not for pie, he wouldn't. He'd call it an adventure. That's what he'd call it. And he'd land on that wreck if it was his last act. And wouldn't he throw a style into it? Wouldn't he spread himself for nothing? Why, you'd think it was Christopher Columbus discovering kingdom come. Boy, I wish Tom Sawyer was here." Well, Jim grumbled a little, but finally he gave in. He said we mustn't talk any more than we could help, and then talk mighty low. The lightning showed us the wreck again, just in time, and we fetched a starboard derrick and made fast there. The deck was high out there. We went sneaking down the slope of it to larboard in the dark, towing the Texas, feeling our way slowly with our feet, spreading our hands out to fend off the guys, for it was so dark we couldn't see no sign of them. Pretty soon, we struck the forward end of the skylight and clung onto it, and the next step fetched us in front of the captain's door, which was open, and by Jiminy, away down through the Texas hall, we see a light, and all in the same second we seemed to hear low voices yonder. Jim whispered and said he was feeling powerful sick and told me to come along. I says all right and was going to start for the raft, but just then I hear a voice wail out and say, "Oh, please don't, boys. I swear I won't ever tell." Another voice said pretty loud, "It's a lie, Jim Turner. You've acted this way before. You always want more and your share of the truck, and you always got it, too, because you've swore if you didn't, you'd tell. But this time, you've just said it one time too many. You're the meanest, treacherousest hound in the country." By this time, Jim was gone for the raft. I was just a biling with curiosity, and I says to myself, "Tom Sawyer wouldn't back out now, and I won't either. I'm a-going to see what's going on here." So I dropped on my hands and knees in the little passage and crept aft in the dark till there weren't but one stateroom betwixt me and the crossed hall of Texas. Then and there I see a man stretched on the floor and tied hand and foot, and two men standing over him, and one of them had a dim lantern in his hand, and the other one had a pistol. This one kept pointing the pistol at the man's head on the floor and saying, "I'd like to, and I order to, a mean skunk." The man on the floor would shrivel up and say, "Oh, please don't, Bill. I ain't ever gonna tell." And every time he said that, the man with the lantern would laugh and say, "'Deed you ain't. You never said no truer thing than that, you betcha." And once he said, "Hear him beg. And yet if we hadn't got the best of him and tied him, he'd have killed us both. And what for? Just for nothing. Just because we stood on our rights, that's what's for. But I lay you, ain't it gonna threaten nobody anymore. Put up the pistol, Bill. Bill says, I don't want to, Jake Packard. I'm for killing him. And didn't he kill old Hatfield just the same way? And don't he deserve it? But I don't want him killed, and I've got my reasons for it. Bless your heart for them words, Jake Packard. I'll never forget you long as I live, says the man on the floor, sort of blubbering. Now Packard didn't take no notice of that, and started toward where I was, and there in the dark, and motioned Bill to come. I crawfished as fast as I could about 2 yards, but the boat slanted so that I couldn't make very good time. So, to keep from getting run over and catched, I crawled into a stateroom on the upper side. The man came a-pawing along in the dark, and when Packard got to my stateroom, he says, here, come in here. And in he come, and Bill after him. But before they got in, I was up in the upper berth, cornered and sorry I come. Then they stood there with their hands on the ledge of the berth and talked. I couldn't see them, but I could tell where they was by the whiskey they'd been having. I was glad I didn't drink the whiskey, but it wouldn't have made much difference anyway, because most of the time they couldn't have treated me because I didn't breathe. I was too scared. And besides, a body couldn't breathe and hear such talk. They talked low and earnest. Bill wanted to kill Turner. He says, he said he'd tell, and he will. If he was to give both of our shares to him now, it wouldn't make no difference after the row and the way we've served him. Sure's you're born, he'll turn state's evidence. Now you hear me. I'm for putting him out of his troubles. So am I, says Packard, very quiet. Blame it? I'd sort of begin to think you wasn't. Well, then that's all right. Let's go and do it. Hold on a minute. I ain't had my say yet. You listen to me. Shooting's good, but there's quieter ways if a thing's got to be done. But what I says is this. It ain't good sense to go courting around after a halter if you can't get at what you're up to in the same way that's just as good and at the same time don't bring you no risks. Ain't that so? You bet it is. But how you gonna manage that this time? Well, my idea is this. We'll rustle around and gather up whatever pickings we've overlooked in the staterooms and shove for shore and hide the truck. Then we'll wait. Now I say, it ain't going to be more than 2 hours before this rack breaks up and washes down off the river, see? He'll be drowned and won't have nobody to blame for it but his own self. Huck Finn, however, waited until the 2 men had left and then freed the unfortunate man. When he got back to the raft and told Jim the story, Jim refused to believe it and said, Huck Finn, you're one heck of a liar, you and your crazy tall tales.